Podcast. Welcome to North Carolina Reading Service. Today is April 22nd, 2024. Your readers this evening are Joe Pinella
and Paula Passmore.
And the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast after this broadcast by visiting us at our website at www.ncreadingservice.org. This broadcast is generously supported by the Forest at Duke. They can be reached at 800-474-0258. We thank them for their contribution. We will begin this evening by reading the USA Today Newsline section, followed by the Money, Sports, and Life sections. Also at 8:30 p.m. this evening, our featured program will be drug and department store ads. Now it is time for our TV listings with Paula.
Thanks, Joe. We'll start with ABC at 8 p.m. From 8 p.m. until 10 o'clock, it's American Idol. 713, Billboard number one hits. The guest mentor, Meghan Trainor, the top 12 perform their favorite Billboard hits live from Hollywood. Then at 10 o'clock on ABC, it's The Interrogating Tapes, a special edition of 2020. On CBS tonight at 8 p.m., it's The Neighborhood. 8:30 is Bob Hart's Abishola. 9 o'clock and 10 o'clock, it's one-hour episodes of NCIS. So from 9 o'clock until the end of primetime, you can watch NCIS. On Fox tonight at 8 p.m., it's Master Chef. 9 o'clock is So You Think You Can Dance. And 10 o'clock is WRL's 10 p.m. news on Fox 50. On NBC tonight at 8 p.m., from 8 p.m. until 10, it's The Voice, the playoffs premiere. Team Legend and Team Dan and Shay's remaining artists hold nothing back as they compete to advance. At 10 o'clock, it's Deal or No Deal. On the ION Network tonight, you can see back-to-back episodes 1 hour each of FBI from 8 p.m. until the end of primetime. On PBS tonight, it's Antiques Roadshow from 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock. At 9 o'clock, it's State of Change. And at 9:30, it's American Experience. And that's from 9:30 until the end of primetime on PBS tonight. On the MNT network, at 8 o'clock, it's Dateline. 9 o'clock is Law & Order Special Victims Unit. And then at 10 o'clock, another episode of Law & Order Special Victims Unit. On CW tonight, 8 p.m., All American. 9 o'clock, Whose Line Is It Anyway? Another episode of Whose Line Is It Anyway at 9:30. And then at 10 o'clock, two back-to-back episodes of National, half-hour each. On A&E tonight, 8 o'clock is Intervention. 9 o'clock is Quarter Ton Teen, from 9 o'clock until the end of primetime. On AMC, there's a movie that begins at 8 o'clock tonight from 8 p.m. until the end of primetime, Avengers, Age of Ultron. That's from 2015 with Chris Hemsworth, Mark Ruffalo, Robert Downey Jr. On BET tonight, two back-to-back half-hour episodes of Pain at 8 p.m. and at 8:30. And then 9 o'clock is Tyler Perry's Diary of a Mad Black Woman from 2005. On the Discovery Channel tonight, that's the Disney Channel tonight, at 8 p.m. is Ladybug. 8:30 is Miraculous Ladybug. And then 9 o'clock is Big City Greens. 9:30 is Big City Greens. And then 10 o'clock, another episode of Miraculous Ladybug. And then 10:30 is Ladybug. On Discovery tonight at 8 o'clock, it's Contraband Seized. And you can watch that show all night through primetime, one-hour episodes. So from 8 to 9, 9 to 10, and so on. On ESPN tonight, the NHL hockey first-round teams were to be announced, and that begins right now at 7 p.m., and then at 9:30, it's NHL hockey, the first-round teams continue. On Nickelodeon tonight, you can see back-to-back episodes, 30 minutes each, of SpongeBob SquarePants. So from 8 o'clock to 8:30 and 8:30 to 9. Then at 9 o'clock, it's back-to-back half-hour episodes of Friends for the rest of the prime time. On TNT tonight, it's NBA basketball. Philadelphia 76ers at New York Knicks Eastern Conference first round game 2. That starts at 7:30 tonight. And then at 10 p.m. tonight, it's Los Angeles Lakers at Denver Nuggets. And as it is every Monday night on USA Network, it's WWE Monday Night Raw from 8 p.m. through the end of primetime.
Thank you, Paul. And kicking off the Newsline section this evening, today is Earth Day. So this profiles Earth Day 2024. Experts spreading optimism and not doom. Many find reasons for hope on climate change. Climate change may still be a threat to humanity, but as Earth Day 2024 rolls around today, some of the people most concerned about the planet are not peddling doom this time. They are peddling optimism. There's plenty to feel good about, they say. Huge strides toward fighting climate change, decades of work that have led to the environmental disasters being averted, and the reality that hope can come and fuel these actions needed to tackle this crisis. People assume that in the 50 years since the first Earth Day, we've made no progress, that we're in worse positions than we were in the 1970s. But that is not true, said Hannah Ritchie, a senior researcher at the University of Oxford in the United Kingdom. She studies sustainability in relation to climate change. Quite the opposite is true, she says. Climate-friendly advances that would have been nearly impossible even 10 years ago are now commonplace. And three times in the past 50 years of humanity, we have fixed massive man-made global environmental issues. This Earth Day, some climate scientists think climate change could be added to the list. That reality is still a long way off, however. But we have made some progress. It's as if humanity has to climb the world's tallest mountain, said Catherine Hayhoe, chief scientist of the Natural Conservancy and distinguished professor of climate science at Texas Tech University. Wind and solar power are the cheapest electricity on the planet, she says, and heat pumps come up in the most heating and cooling discussions that she has taken part in. Electric cars are now becoming mainstream. Monday brings even more funding for climate-friendly causes, with the Biden administration announcing $7 billion in grants to provide solar power to more than 900,000 homes in low-income and disadvantaged communities, the White House said over the weekend, actually. It's like climbing the world's tallest mountain, she says, Hayhoe stated. You walk and walk and you climb and climb, and the top never seems like it's getting closer. But when you turn around, you do realize how far you've come. Even Al Gore, former senator and former vice president, who famously began warning Americans about global warming in 1981, feels a little bit more positive. In March, he acknowledged to USA Today that things aren't moving fast enough, but said we're gaining on this, we're gaining momentum, and soon we'll be gaining on that crisis. Humanity has already had some amazing wins when it comes to other big, seemingly unbeatable environmental issues. Take DDT, for example, a pesticide originally seen as a miracle in the fight against mosquitoes and other vermin when it was first introduced back in the 1940s. It wasn't until late 1950s that scientists connected the dots between declining bird populations and the new wonder chemical. DDT thinned eggshells so that nesting mothers crushed their own babies, leading many species, including the bald eagle, on the brink of extinction. But DDT was banned in 1972, and by 2007, bald eagles had made such a comeback that they were removed from the endangered species list. Or look up at the sky and ponder the ozone layer that protects us from the ultraviolet radiation from the sun. In the early 1980s, scientists saw that a hole had developed in that critically protective layer of the atmosphere. Without it, fields would burn and the outdoors would seem unsurvivable. Despite the cost and the immensity of the problem, nations around the world had signed the Montreal Protocol, phasing out these carbons that cause the hole. Today, the ozone is repairing itself and is expected to return to 1980 levels by 2060. Then there was acid rain, the byproduct of burning sulfur-laced coal, beginning back in the 1950s. It killed forests and life in lakes and streams across the Northeast. And with public awareness and the dangers growing into the 1970s, Congress ended up passing the Clean Air Act of 1990. This helped limit the emissions, and levels began to fall very quickly. It's important to remember that history when considering this grim news about carbon dioxide levels in the Earth's atmosphere, the root cause of global warming. Last year, they hit the highest point in human history, 420 parts per million. That's up from 280 parts per million since the Industrial Revolution. In that time, global temperatures have risen by about 2 degrees. But there is something else happening that doesn't get as much attention or noticed that often, but it's very helpful. Experts, including the International Agency on Environmental Energy, say that global carbon dioxide emissions will probably peak next year and certainly by 2030, using this scenario based on current policy settings. That means by 2023, that means 2023 was very likely the last year with the highest greenhouse gas emissions ever, and numbers will only go down from here. While that won't make up for all the CO2 that has been pumped into the Earth's atmosphere since the mid-1970s, it's an important milestone and shows the energy shift is already well underway. The transition to clean energy is happening worldwide and it's unstoppable, IEA Director Faith Patrol had said last year. It's not a question of if, it's just a question of how soon, she stated. That said, current emission levels are the third highest than they need to be to limit global warming to 2.5 degrees. So global per capita emissions still must come down significantly. But progress is being made, and it is getting to be apparent to the general public, Hannah Ritchie also said. And clean energy is now the cheapest energy. That progress is being aided by more good news. Clean energy from solar and wind has gotten very cheap and is much faster than climate experts have ever hoped for that to happen. The world is fundamentally a different place from what it was in 1970 or even just a decade ago. We're in a different position, Ritchie also states. She has a book on this topic, Not the End of the World, How We Can Be the First Generation to Build a Sustainable Future. This came out last January. She also says that the work necessary to fix climate change can seem overwhelming, but it's actually not as bad as it might seem. The solutions overlap, so one problem with you're making progress on might get better also at the same time. Keeping this front and center can be hard because the same voices that have been denying climate change for decades now have added to what's known as the doomerism into their toolbox. Even those who are overwhelmed by climate change can stay frozen into the inaction. If you had said years ago that in the year 2023, 80% of all new electricity installed worldwide is going to be solar and wind, I would have said, wow, that's great. But that's happening last year. If somebody had said 20%, I would say, wow, that's even better. She often cites the famous saying from the late economist Rudy Dornbusch, who said that things take longer than you think they will, but they will happen faster than you thought they could, he said. Paula.
Thanks, Joe. Continuing in the front section, there's a fairly long article about the rise in anti-Semitism that varies across the U.S. I'll read it in an edited fashion due to the length. Jewish experience is different depending on location. And this article's surrounded by several photographs. Maim Bialik in Israel is shown here, and she's in on the TV show. And then there are a few Jewish symbols, and then there's a rabbi hugging someone after the Oklahoma City Jewish Community Prayer Vigil for Israel at a temple in Oklahoma City. So this is from Leora Arowitz, Daniel Gonzalez, Jose Gonzalez, Daniel Oliver, Megan Stewart, and Bibi Hodges. In Nevada, there are Jewish people who have hidden any signs of their faith, painting over the mezuzahs that hang outside their home. That's happened in Texas, too, where a Jewish city council member's home in Dallas was defaced with bright red graffiti. But Jews in South Carolina say Christians in their community will stop them on the streets to offer prayers. Sometimes they even get a hug, just for being Jewish. Anti-Semitism is on the rise in America. Some places you feel that, Jews across the country say, other places you don't. States are not a monolith, nor are people, but we set out to answer a question. What does the widely reported surge in anti-Semitism look like? As we interviewed people, there were things we heard over and over. Jews are frightened, they're frustrated, and they all worry about it, even if they feel safe in their own communities. Anti-Semitism impacts secular Jews and religious ones, children and adults, regular folks, and TV stars. Actress Maim Bialik says Jews everywhere are having the same surreal conversations. I thought about taking my mezuzah down in the weeks and first couple of months after October 7, and I don't think about that anymore, but I do have a pervasive fear that I'll be confronted by someone, especially since I'm a public face of being Jewish, says the former Big Bang Theory star. It's a fear that I think many of us have experienced, even if you're not a public person. Bialik feels a responsibility to speak out. I never thought that my platform would have to be used to defend the rights of Jews to exist. I was raised and educated and even studied the Jewish experience in America, and I knew that there was tremendous amount of anti-Semitism, both covert and overt, but I did not understand the scale, she says. I had no idea of the scale. On Monday night, Jews will gather for Passover. They'll eat matzah and sing songs and tell the story of the Exodus, a story that carries more weight this year. After all, the Passover story is in part a tale of Jews leaving a place where they no longer felt they could live at ease. Some Jews say they feel that way today, in America. Jews are talking about, do you have a passport? Are you armed? People are actually having these conversations, says Shoshana Stein-Benerach, 43, who runs the TikTok account at My So-Called Jewish Life. Her kosher cooking videos have been inundated with hate. Yet perhaps one of the more interesting phenomena in recent months is that of Jews returning to their synagogues and leaning into their Judaism rather than shying away from it. What we're seeing is a tremendous amount of this Jewish awakening, says Rabbi Mati Seligson, Director of Public Relations for Chadba.org. We're seeing Jews doubling down on their Judaism by spending more time with fellow Jews by becoming more Jewish. The past 6 months have been a wake-up call, Seligson says. I think all of this hate just came to the surface. It's not like it didn't exist. You just needed the right circumstances to expose it. Here are a sampling of what the Jews we spoke to had to say about their experiences, and I'll read a few. In Arizona, in Phoenix, Carolyn Binger plans to forego her yearly outdoor Passover decorations. She typically places them over her balcony with two blue blankets with fish drawing glued on in representation of Moses parting the Red Sea during the Exodus. She and her family wanted to hang the Israeli flag in that same place recently, but decided against it. We're very close to some major streets, and we decided it would be safer to not do that, Binger said. Ilana Ikovic, who's Orthodox, says she too was on a heightened alert after the war broke out in Israel. She'd tense up every time a car would slow down as she walked to and from synagogue during the Sabbath. But all the encounters she's had in public have been positive. The mother of five recalled one incident in particular. An older woman approached Ikovic while she was taking her one-year-old for a stroll. The woman said, "Your daughter's so beautiful," Ikovic recalls, and then added, "I want you to know that we're thinking of you and we're praying for you." Ikovic responded, "Thank you so much. That means a lot to me and my baby. She's less fearful now." And in California, Jews say that Berkeley, the city, and the UC Berkeley campus have felt like hotbeds for anti-Semitism since the war broke out. The violence is increasing because along with the verbal violence has come physical violence, says Dorothea Dorenz, the 76-year-old, has been a resident of the city of the Berkeley since the 70s. Tensions have been especially high on the UC Berkeley campus since a February 26th event featuring a speaker from Israel ended in violence. Protesters outside, many masked, broke down the doors, campus police told the AP. One police report alleges a victim was spit at and kicked. Two others allege battery. People are finding that their friends are turning away from them, and that's why we're finding anti-Semitic graffiti on people's businesses. They're defacing and they're calling for boycotts of Jewish businesses. This is like the Nazi Germany's what's going on here. And in Florida, in South Florida, along a busy street, sits a billboard advertising an Israeli radio station. Tune to 107.1 for music, ads, and occasional commentary, all in Hebrew. It's not uncommon to see cars driving around with Israeli flags flapping from their windows. Some are adorned with decals that mimic the 8x11-inch missing persons posters featuring the hostages that were displayed and torn down shortly after the war began. For many local Jews, rising antisemitism is a concern, but a distant one. We're very lucky, says Soshana Stein Benarak, 43. She displays a large Israeli flag outside her home. We're blessed to be here. The very pro-Jewish dynamic that is down here in South Florida and having such a huge Jewish community also makes a difference. And from Idaho. Recently, as the Jewish holiday of Purim approached, Rabbi Mendel Lifshitz received a large box on the doorstep of his Chabad Center in Boise. I open it up, and there is a case of 100 kosher hamantaschen cookies in there, he says. The package came from a non-Jew. We have a lot of these instances where people reach out and tell us how much they support us. Jews in Boise have flocked to his synagogue in recent months. I always preach to my community that our job is pro-Semitism. What can we do to make sure that Jews feel proud and secure? I can't tell you how many people have said, Rabbi, I'm going to put up a mezuzah on my door. People are just stepping up because they feel so ignited Jewishly. That's been the silver lining for us.
Thank you, Paul. And former President Donald Trump's hush money trial has jurors selected. A diverse group includes lawyers and teachers. The 12 jurors who will decide the outcome of the first criminal trial of a former president are an accomplished group of Manhattanites, including lawyers, teachers, and other highly educated professionals. On Friday, a full panel of 12 jurors and 6 alternates were seated, and Judge Juan Merchan told the jurors he expected to begin the trial on Monday. Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to cover up a payment issue to porn star Stormy Daniels while Trump was first running for office to keep her quiet about their alleged affair in 2006. Merchan told the press on Thursday to exercise caution in reporting on jury activities as to not include any personally identifying information. The instruction came after juror number 2, who was selected Tuesday, was dismissed because she said she was concerned about her identity becoming public. She said friends and other colleagues had reached out to her Wednesday following media coverage of the jury selection. But we do know 7 men and 5 women make up the jury, according to multiple reports. The jurors were selected Tuesday, as reported by CBS News. Juror number 1, the 4 person, is a man who works in sales. He reads the New York Times, the Daily Mail, and Fox News, as well as MSNBC, he says. Juror number 3, a corporate lawyer who said he is not very familiar with the other charges Trump faces. Juror number 5, a woman working as a school teacher who indicated she doesn't care to follow political news closely. President Trump speaks his mind. I would rather have that than someone who's in office and you don't know what they're saying and doing behind the scenes. Juror number 6 is a software engineer who said she can see Trump as a normal person on trial. Juror number 7, a man who is a civil litigator and has children. And juror number 8 is a retired man married with 2 kids who's more interested in his hobbies than news regarding Trump. Juror number 9, a woman with a master's degree who works as a speech therapist. Juror number 10 is a man who works in retail, does not follow the news, except to listen to psychology podcasts. He is unmarried. Replaced juror number 2 is a married investment banker with a master's degree. He follows Trump on social media and likes the book The Art of the Deal. Replaced juror number four is a married man working as a security engineer with a high school diploma. He said he is not on social media. Juror number 11, a woman who works for an apparel company, who said she did not like the president's persona, calling him selfish and self-serving. Trump's team asked for her to be dismissed, but Merchan denied that request. And juror number 12 is a physical therapist with a doctorate degree. She reads the New York Times, USA Today, and watches CNN. District Attorney Alvin Bragg charged Trump with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to cover up the $130,000 paid to adult film actress Stormy Daniels. Trump has pleaded not guilty to all counts, and Trump's former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, pleaded guilty in the 2018 case of concealing more than $4 million from the IRS and causing $280,000 in payments to be made to silence two women who otherwise planned to speak publicly about the alleged affairs with a presidential candidate, thereby intending to influence the 2016 presidential election. This according to court records. The other $150,000 was paid to former Playboy model Karen McDougal. Paula.
A House at last approves aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. From Washington, the House approved a set of long-awaited foreign aid bills on Saturday that would send funds to Ukraine, Israel, and the Indo-Pacific region after months of it being stalled by Republican infighting. Passage of the bills could also cost Speaker Mike Johnson his leadership position and status as second in line to the presidency. The bills mostly mirror an earlier foreign aid package the Senate passed this year, but this one's broken up into pieces as an attempt by Johnson, a Louisiana Republican, to appease his conference by allowing GOP lawmakers to pick and choose what aspects of the bill they support. Johnson's foreign aid plan includes three bills that separately fund Ukraine, Israel, and the Indo-Pacific region, along with a fourth bill that includes various GOP-backed foreign policy priorities as a sweetener to entice Republicans to back the proposal. Those provisions would include seizing frozen Russian assets to fund the Ukrainian war effort, along with legislation that could result in a nationwide ban on the popular social media app TikTok. All bills passed the House on a bipartisan basis, but the legislation funding Ukraine proved to be the most contentious as U.S. support for Kiev continues to fall among the House GOP ranks. The House passed the bill providing roughly $60 billion in Ukraine by a vote of 311 to 112. The Israel bill also proved to be problematic among progressive Democrats who've called for conditioning aid to the country over its conduct in the war-torn Gaza Strip, as international aid organizations warn of incoming famine in the territory. Lawmakers approved more than $26 billion in Israel funding and humanitarian assistance in the region by a vote of 366 to 58. Aid to the Indo-Pacific region aimed at deterring China was far less controversial, and lawmakers passed about $8 billion to the region by a vote of 385 to 34. The sweetener bill also passed 360 to 58. All four bills will be compiled into one package to send to the Senate, which is expected to approve the legislation as well. President Joe Biden has vowed to sign the package immediately to send a message to the world. We stand with our friends, and we won't let Iran or Russia succeed. The final package was a long time coming and came together after months of dithering by Johnson, who was under intense pressure by leaders from both sides of the aisle to advance foreign aid. At first, Johnson sided with ultra-conservative lawmakers who insisted that any assistance abroad must be paired with significant changes to border and immigration policy to address the crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. But in recent days, the speaker appeared to have shifted in his views of foreign aid, delivering remarks to reporters on Wednesday about the urgent need for the U.S. to show support for its allies. Providing lethal aid to Ukraine right now is critically important. I really do believe the intel and the briefings that we've gotten. I believe Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin and Iran really are an axis of evil. I think they're in coordination on this. I think that Vladimir Putin would continue to march through Europe if he were allowed, Johnson said. To put it bluntly, I'd rather send bullets to Ukraine than American boys, Johnson continued, adding that his son, is entering the U.S. Naval Academy this fall. This is a live fire exercise for me, as it is for many American families. This is not a game. This is not a joke. Passage of the foreign aid package also appears like it will leave Johnson's speakership in peril. Conservative firebrand Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, along with two other Republicans, are seeking to oust the Speaker for working with Democrats to pass legislation. Greene has declined to offer a timeline for when she would move to remove the Speaker, but has previously suggested that she would do so the moment the House passes Ukraine aid. Regardless, Johnson and his philosophy said his philosophy is do the right thing and you let the chips fall where they may. And then he was willing to take personal risk for his job if it meant Congress could pass foreign aid. A small group of bipartisan negotiators in the Senate cobbled together a foreign aid package that did include sweeping changes in border and immigration policy that looked ready to clear the upper chamber earlier this year. But at the behest of former President Donald Trump, who opposed the bill, congressional Republicans ultimately killed the deal. The Senate later passed the foreign aid package completely stripped of changes in border policy, and as months went by, Senate leaders from both parties called on Johnson to pass the deal immediately. The Speaker ultimately opted to split the bill into several different components with slight modifications to win Republican support, including converting direct financial assistance to Ukraine as a loan that can eventually be forgiven by the U.S. In an attempt to placate the hard right who were incensed by the Speaker's decision, a fifth bill that resembled a strict partisan bill Republicans passed last year to address the southern border, referred to as H.R.2, was offered a vote on the floor but failed to garner the support necessary to pass. Conservatives derided the bill that appeared to be a peace offering as an attempt from the Speaker to save face. What happens next in the lower chamber is uncertain as House lawmakers began a week-long recess right after passing the foreign aid package on Saturday. Once they returned to Capitol Hill, Johnson's expected to enter a political fight for his life as Greene, backed by other conservatives, threatened to supplant him.
Thank you, Paula. And it is time for our announcements this evening. And this is really cool. Accessible Pharmacy, Blindness, and Mental Health Summit. Accessible Pharmacy is a provider of home-delivered prescription medicines with talking bottles. It's hosting its first annual Blindness and Mental Health Summit. This virtual and free summit is the largest online gathering of organizations and consumers sharing information, resources, and services focusing on mental health in the blindness, low vision, and disability communities. The Blindness and Mental Health Summit will be held online on Friday, June 14th. This is from noon until 4. Again, that's Friday, June 14th, noon till 4. And for more information or to register for this free online event, visit the Accessible Pharmacy website at accessiblepharmacy, all one word, .com. You will find the Blindness and Mental Health Summit under the Events tab. And the North Carolina Assistive Technology Program, NCATP, is hosting a pop-up fair. Get active and get outdoors. The North Carolina Assistive Technology Program has been hosting these pop-up fairs at various locations throughout North Carolina. Learn about the local resources and get hands-on experience with accessible equipment, regardless of your ability at an adaptive recreation and active living resource fair. These fairs are free and open to the public. We encourage everyone interested in staying active, accessible recreation, and leisure activities are on hand to be attended. And they will be at the following location. There's just one left. May 3rd from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Charlotte AT Center in Charlotte. The event is free, but registration is required. And to register or learn more about the NCATP nearest you, visit their website at www.ncdhhs.gov/NCATP. And tactile tours are available at the North Carolina Museum of Art. These are designed for visitors who are blind or have low vision. These docent-led tours explore the museum's collection through audio description and tactile experiences by engaging all the senses. Tours are by request only and are scheduled at least 2 weeks in advance. To schedule a tactile tour, please call 919-664-6854 or email their accessibility coordinator, Molly Hull, at mhull, that's M as in Molly, H-U-L-L, at ncartmuseum.org. And there's a call for art celebrations. Arts Access Gallery is excited to host its second exhibition titled A Celebration of the ADA. This features works of art created by North Carolina artists with disabilities. As they celebrate their 40th anniversary and the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, commemorates its 34th year, they want you to know how to celebrate in life. The exhibition will be on view at the Arts Access Gallery in downtown Raleigh, June 7th through July 26th of this year. The gallery is located at 444 South Blount Street. I'm not sure how that's pronounced, Suite 115B in Raleigh. And the zip code there is 27601. This exhibition is open to North Carolina artists who identify as having a disability and are at least 18 years of age. Works from both the established and emerging artists are welcome. The submission deadline is April 22nd, 2024, so that is today. For more information on the exhibition and to apply, please visit the Arts Access website. The full call for art can be found on the Arts Access Gallery page. That's at www.artsaccessinc.org. And you are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, connecting people who are blind and print impaired to each other, their families, and communities by delivering news, information, and entertainment using the latest audio technology. In addition to using these specially tuned sub-channel radio receivers, NCRS streams our programming on our website at ncreadingservice.org. You can listen by using the Listen Live streaming audio player located at the upper right-hand corner of the webpage. If you have an assisted technology device, such as Alexa or Google Home, just say tune in to NC Reading Service to listen instantly. We also provide podcasts of over 50 magazines and other information and entertainment programs following this initial broadcast. Please visit our website at ncreadingservice.org. Click the Listen tab and then click on Skip to Podcast section. For more information regarding the North Carolina Reading Service, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, 919-5138. I'm sorry, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and Paula is going to get us going on our opinions.
Thanks, Joe. This opinion is offered by two teachers in New York, Karen Mardar and Randy Weingarten. Karen Martin is a teacher in Queens, New York. Randy Weingarten is president of the American Federation of Teachers. And so here we begin. As teachers, we try to impart to young people that life often defies binary delineations. As Jews, we can be heartsick and horrified over the October 7 attack on Israel by Hamas, the death, suffering, and capture of hundreds of Israelis, and now as the war rate drags on, thousands of innocent Palestinians. We can demand the release of Israeli hostages and fight for humanitarian aid for Gazans now starving. We can fight against hate and for free expression. We can embrace security, freedom, and self-determination for both peoples. What is not up for debate is this, our basic humanity. That goes for students and for adults who guide them. 2 days after the Hamas massacre, one of us, Karen Martyr, a teacher at Hillcrest High School in Queens, New York, attended a vigil with others who were devastated by the deadliest attack on Jews since the Holocaust. I stand with Israel sign. Karen, this is Karen's perspective, news of the torture, rape, and slaughter of young people at a music festival especially disturbed me. I saw their zest for life in my own young adult children and the thousands of students I'd taught over more than two decades. I posted a photo on Facebook of myself holding a sign reading, I Stand with Israel. That act in the hours after the Hamas assaults would lead to a devastating response from students I care about deeply. Several of Karen's students circulated screenshots of the photo and called for a riot targeting her. On November 20, hundreds of students stormed the hallway and tried to get into her classroom, cursing and threatening and calling for her to be fired. Karen was elsewhere in the building, but watched all of this on monitors, and she later saw videos that students shared online. In a cruel irony, the lesson she had planned to teach on the day of the riot was about hate crimes. I wasn't going to run away. Karen. I had a chance to transfer to a different school. I stayed to use the experience to connect, to listen, learn, debunk misinformation, and combat intolerance. The day I returned to school, a Palestinian friend, a fellow teacher, and I met with students. I answered their questions and shared my feelings. I repeated the hurtful, threatening, and untrue things that students had said during the riot and on social media, helping them connect with my humanity and their own. Many of my students hugged me and apologized for what had occurred. For me, it was difficult to go back to work. What happened to me was frightening and horrible and something that no teacher, staff member, or student should ever have to experience, particularly in a school building. Dealing with that trauma and the press surrounding it is a long process, one that will take time to heal. However, I went back because I knew one thing. I had to talk with my students. I had to make them understand the concern of my post, the context of my post, and why it was posted when it was. I had to listen. I had to understand what messages they were absorbing and where they were coming from. I had to answer their questions, address their fears and confusions, and simply be there. Further, I had to show them that I wasn't going to run away, even though some of them behaved inappropriately. They had to see through my actions that I would not give up on them, that I'd keep coming in again and again. That said, those conversations were not easy. Trust, once breached, must be earned back. Teachers must model so much for students: forgiveness, active listening, acknowledging wrongs, and sitting with uncomfortable feelings. We don't have to paint things as black or white, right or wrong. We humans can see nuance, shades of gray, areas of commonality among difference. This is what gives me hope as a teacher navigating the challenging world of school and students, but also for the situation between Israel and Palestine. There is another path forward for all humans, one of peace, negotiation, and decency. As teachers, we can start our students on that road. As acts of hate against Muslims and Jews have surged in recent months, and as the culture wars have targeted people for their race, sexual orientation, and gender identity, people have become scared. We hear this from teachers all the time. Karen's experience and her response show a way forward. Schools must be safe and welcoming spaces, safe from physical violence and safe for people regardless of who they are. That means acts of anti-Semitic and anti-Arab hate must be addressed, not ignored. But we need more than that. Education is about knowledge, of course, but knowledge is more than memorizing facts. It involves critical thinking, empathy, and deepening understanding of respect and respect for diverse backgrounds and perspectives. A ray of light. Karen, I didn't hide, and neither should others. If something is brewing, we must act, not pretend it will go away. That's what Karen's union, the United Federation of Teachers, did days before the riot, and that's what New York City Schools Chancellor David Banks has pledged to do. In our public schools and our public squares, we must responsibly exercise our right to free speech, combat hate, intolerance and misinformation, and foster respectful discussions and debates, even and perhaps especially about our challenging topics. Karen's actions are a ray of light in our hope for a peaceful solution to this most intractable of conflicts, anchored in our shared values of empathy and basic humanity.
And our second opinion piece is on a similar note. This is written by opinion contributor Nathan Diamant. Passover arrives at a dangerous time for Jews. Jews will gather Monday for Passover, as we have for centuries, and children are taught to ask four questions with this opening. Why is this night different from any other night? This year, there is a fifth question American Jewish families will ask. What is our place today in America? This year, Jews will celebrate Passover in the shadow of Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel, the bloodiest day for Jews since the Holocaust, and amid the largest surge in anti-Semitism ever in the United States. As we celebrate our freedom from Egypt, we will think about the Jews who are hostages in Gaza, taken captive solely because they are Jews. We will cry as we retell the biblical stories against our ancestors that rhyme with the brutality of our present-day foes. And for American Jews, our current anxiety is not only out of concern for our Israeli brothers and sisters, it is also because we are shocked by those who have taken to the streets to praise Hamas and denounce Jews. In the United States, unprecedented protests have been mounted outside synagogues and Jewish-owned businesses and have being vandalized. And, of course, there is this over-the-top protesting on university campuses where Jewish students and faculty are harassed and threatened without consequence. In this context, in this moment, every American Jewish family will ask at their table, is this the golden age of, is the golden age of American Jews over? A teenager will turn to a grandparent and ask, are we watching a replay of the 1930s Germany here? Those questions will be asked by Orthodox Jews who are acutely tuned to the patterns of Jewish history, which tells us that the, quote, golden ages have come and gone for centuries. And by these questions, we will be asking liberal Jews who might have reservations about how Israel has been prosecuted and how the war against Hamas has taken place, but with greater reservations about the Ernst and while friends and colleagues siding with Hamas. These Jews have fought on the front lines of many progressive causes for racial, economic, women's, and LGBTQ plus rights. But now they find themselves abandoned by alleged allies when it was time to stand against Jews being victims of rape and murder. And while this provides an answer to the four traditional Passover questions, it leaves this question of the moment unanswered. That answer will depend on the American people and how we collectively write our course and respond to this very decisive moment in American Jewish history. But the Passover story makes one thing clear. In the age-old fight between good, evil, and other negative things, good will triumph. There's a reason that this Passover is the most observed Jewish ritual across the full spectrum of the Jewish calendar. It holds a message of promise, one that Jewish people will endure in the face of unimaginable evil. Great empires have come and gone, like the Greek Empire, Roman, Ottoman, and British. They all have come and gone, but with that, Jews have remained. Today, Americans have the opportunity to side with a good and freedom over, with good and freedom over evil, a society that turns the other cheek in the face of those who are persecuting Jews. Because they are Jews, will ultimately lose freedoms for all. From university administrators to the White House to the average man on the street, this is a decisive moment for all of us. Our choice as a country will not only determine what happens to the Jewish people, but what happens to the American people as well. And again, this by Nathan Diamant. He is the Executive Director of Public Policy for the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America, and he is a special opinion contributor to USA Today. Paula. Paula is going to start us on money.
This Meta AI gets an upgrade. Llama 3 offers search new creation features. This is by Jennifer Jolly. All the big tech companies are trying to best each other with the, hey, look what our artificial intelligence can do now updates. And on Thursday, Facebook parent company Meta rolled out its latest upgrade in a version called Llama 3. Unlike previous Llama releases, Llama 3 has its dedicated website, Meta AI, where you can use the tool for free. It's a riff on the ChatGPT formula. No charge. Go and talk to it and see what it can do for you. The catch, of course, is that you log in with a Facebook account. Big day here. We're releasing the new version of Meta AI, our assistant, that you can ask any question across our apps and our glasses. Meta Platform CEO Mark Zuckerberg said in a statement sent to USA Today, we built it into the search box right at the top of the WhatsApp, Instagram, Facebook, and Messenger, so anytime you have a question, you can just ask it right there. We're also releasing a bunch of unique creation features. Meta AI now creates animations and creates high-quality images so fast that it generates and updates images for you in real time as you're typing. Some of my friends already see the Ask Meta AI Anything prompt at the top of their search feed, but it hasn't shown up in any of mine yet. Meta upgrades typically roll out in this way, though. Some people get them right away, while others have to wait a bit. Will it change your life in any way? Absolutely not. Do you care about it? Maybe. Let's dive in. What does Meta AI do? The most interesting thing I've seen it do so far is to generate realistic-looking animated characters and images that update while you're still typing in the prompts. Just type what you want to see, and the image begins to generate as you type. Here's an example. You want to see a curly-haired girl flying a dragon? Type curly girl, and it's there. The image continues to adapt to fit your narrative as you're typing. The only limitation is your imagination. It's like you can choose your own adventure, but with no scary consequences. What's really cool about real-time image generation is that it doesn't wait for the entire prompt to be written. Instead, it starts to see each object as you write it and adjust the final image in real time. This requires powerful hardware and software, which is fascinating to watch in action. What could possibly go wrong? It's a great time waster and obviously a very powerful tool. We'll have to see if Meta's lewd content filters are up to the snuff, however, as that's a problem that plagued similar tools from Microsoft, Midjourney, and all the rest. Regarding guardrails, most high-profile AI image generators from Microsoft and others have blacklisted keywords that allow them to generate images of famous people like movie stars and high-profile politicians. The data sets these models use typically don't include normal people, so typing your friend's name into the AI isn't going to produce anything that looks like them. There are always ways around these. Other AI image generators have been fighting against since day one. Meta AI for searching and winning arguments with friends. What about generating fake images that people think are real, like of politicians during the upcoming elections? I'm going to get back to that in a second, but first there are a few things that the company says the new Meta AI can do. Act as a personal assistant. Enable more powerful search. Create faster and more tailored images. During a video call demonstration earlier this week, a Facebook spokesperson said he expects people to use Meta AI for fun and to be more social. To me, that means they're trying to make Facebook more fun for more than just our parents and make Instagram more interesting so that young people don't keep ditching it for TikTok. Harsh, but kind of true, even though Facebook still has around 3 billion active users per month, which is about a third of the world's population, according to digital marketing site Social Surge. Llama 3 will be available in 12 countries, including Canada, Australia, and South Africa, all of which are getting this technology for the first time. Meta's open-source large language model. It's similar to ChatGPT, which is about to unveil its upgraded model, GPT-5. Models like these power AI apps such as chatbots, image generators, and virtual assistants. Why is Meta investing in so much in AI? Meta's doing this because having a large language model like Llama 3 means you can add new features to your apps, like adding AI to the search feature on Facebook and Instagram. It adds a layer of smarts and can reduce friction between users and the apps they like. By building its own high-powered AI, Meta can also sell licenses to companies that want to use it for their projects. ChatGPT runs on the same licensing business model, where access to AI is granted for companies and their users for a specific fee. Excuse me. Meta stands to make a lot of money with the LLM, which is a large language machine, in various ways, including advertising. Think auto-generated ads that appeal to you specifically and selling access to this AI. Facebook has one of the largest stockpiles of any company's data, thanks to more than a decade of user-generated content in the form of posts, comments, replies, and so on. This data trains Llama in how to talk to humans, make connections between words and the objects, places, and concepts. And that's why they're investing in it.
All right, continuing on in the money section, some rules of flying etiquette remain disputed. How can so many of you be so wrong? I've written about airplane etiquette before, and I've always thought the rules were pretty obvious, but it turns out not so. This is written by Zach Wichter. It is in our money section, but does read sort of like an opinion. Etiquette depends on a shared understanding of right and wrong, and apparently we all can't even agree on airplane armrests. I've always thought it was an unwritten but absolute rule that the person in the middle seat gets access to both armrests as a courtesy. However, a 2023 survey by online booking platform Kayak polled more than 1,000 adults and found that more than half of you, 57%, disagree with the idea that if you're in the middle seat, you get to claim both armrests, which is honestly crazy to me because it's a matter of decency. Obviously, we travel a bunch ourselves at Kayak, and one of them is the things that we've noticed has been increasingly that the airport has always been one of the places where rules are super strictly enforced, but that rules are also out the window sometimes, said Matthew Clark, who's vice president of the North American Division for Marketing for Kayak. You can have a margarita at 6:30 in the morning, but you can't bring more than 3.4 ounces of liquid through security. So what's the deal? Who gets the armrests, and what is the other unwritten and unenforceable rules of air travel? There's no definite answer. Disclaimer, I don't care about the survey results. I will stick to the adage that the window seat person gets to control the shade, the middle seat person gets both armrests, and the aisle seat person gets to benefit from a little extra legroom. But according to Kayak's survey, only 43% of air travelers agree with me. Even Clark said he was surprised by that result. This is what you get when you pull 1,000 people, he says, nodding to how little common ground we have on some things. Joe Schultz, 38, said he flies at least two or three times a month and is one of the people who disagrees with me. Maybe 10, 15 years ago, I was like, yeah, middle seat people, they should get that armrest. But now it's like, nah, doesn't make sense, the Los Angeles resident told me. He said as airplanes pack more people into economy, he sees the armrests as more of a physical barrier between seats than anything else, a line that's not to be crossed or infringed upon. Regardless of whether you choose to sit in the middle, I don't think you're entitled to that armrest, he adds. As soon as that person in the middle puts their arms on the armrest, you're getting jabbed by their elbows. Still, with 57% of travelers in Schultz's camp, a fair number seem to agree that the middle seat person should get both armrests. I'd say it's an unwritten rule, but it's written a lot, not just policy. It's a common courtesy, said Ryan Craig, 49, told me. Greg, an automation technician from Lawrence, Kansas, flies about twice a week and said he often will switch his flight if there are only middle seats available. However, he has no other choice sometimes, and he expects both armrests when he does. It's one thing that you can get for being stuck in there, at least, he says. We may not be able to agree about armrests, but at least 94% of us can agree that airplanes are not the right place to pop your pimples, according to Kayak. Actually, why isn't that number 100%? No matter their views on the armrest issue specifically, everyone I spoke to for this column agreed that being a decent seat neighbor is all that matters to flying. Just be a decent human being. You're stuck together for as long as the flight depends on it. And I just keep saying that to myself, Craig states. Perhaps not surprisingly, they didn't all have the same exact ideas on how to carry out that advice, but frequent travelers have some good insights. And here's to sum up what frequent travelers have said. Help everyone maximize overhead bin space by consolidating your stuff. Don't let anyone else hear your electronics. Give the person behind you a heads up before you recline your seat. But really the best advice of all is to keep reading Cruising Altitude for all the latest air travel and flying etiquette tips. I see what he did there. He got in his little ad. All right, so Paula's got our last money piece.
Yeah, let's keep it in the air. Allegiant Air tops rankings on handling mobility devices. This is by Jack Wicker. U.S. Airlines got a little bit better with mobility devices in 2023. The 10 major carriers transported 835,327 wheelchairs and other aids last year, and there were 11,527 reports of damage, according to the Department of Transportation. That's a rate of 1.38 devices damaged per 100 carried, down from 1.41 per 100 in 2022. USA Today covered incidents of mobility device damage by airlines throughout 2023, and a recurring theme in the reporting was when the wheelchairs or other mobility devices are damaged in transit, it's akin to broken legs for the person who uses the device. The DOT tracks these incidents and released full year numbers in February. The data showed a slight improvement in wheelchair handling across the industry, but for advocates and regulators, it's still not enough. Any number greater than zero is not an acceptable number, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg told USA Today. This is not only affects our trip, it affects your life. So just a quick rundown of how many mobility devices did the major U.S. airlines mishandle this year? Well, as we said, it's in the multi-hundred thousands, but here are the top five airlines who did it the best. Allegiant Air, Delta Airlines, United Airlines, Hawaiian Airlines, and JetBlue. Coming in at the bottom is Spirit Airlines at number 10, Frontier Airlines at number 9, and Alaska Airlines at number 7 is American, and number 6 is Southwest. But the Frontier Airlines did not provide comments about their performance, and still Delta, United, Hawaiian, JetBlue, American, Alaska, and Southwest all emphasize that they understand the importance of mobility devices to the travelers who rely on them, and pointed out various investments and improvements they've made towards accessibility in recent years. Spirit Airlines, which had notably worse performance than its competitor, said it aims to improve, but did not outline specific steps it was taking. We are committed to safely transporting our guests and their mobility devices, and we are looking into this to ensure that the level of service being provided consistently meets our standards, a statement from the airline said.
Thank you, Paula. And starting off our sports section, the Cardinals and Chargers face big draft decisions. Stick and pick or trade down. The Arizona Cardinals and Los Angeles Chargers both find themselves in a position at the top of the 2024 NFL draft that comes along with a tough decision. The Cardinals and Chargers, who have picked numbers 4 and 5 respectively in the 3-day draft that starts Thursday, are the only teams in the top 5 with franchise quarterbacks on their roster in Kyler Murray and Justin Herbert. The first three picks of the 2024 draft are widely expected to be quarterbacks. There's speculation that the first four picks could be quarterbacks for the first time in NFL history, and that scenario is certainly plausible if the Cardinals trade out of the coveted number 4 spot. We've had talks with multiple teams, and multiple teams have checked in with us, Cardinals General Manager Monty Ossenfort said Thursday during the team's pre-draft press conference. That happens beforehand. That happens on the clock. Different teams have different motivations. We'll see how this one plays out. Ossenfort has shown a willingness to trade, and the Cardinals GM has orchestrated 9 trades since he was named to the role in 2023. He completed 4 trades in the first 3 rounds of last year's draft. Arizona's 11 total 2024 draft picks are currently tied for an NFL high. They have 6 selections in the top 100. We're going to do what's best for the long term and for the team this year, he says. There's rationale for the Cardinals to stay at number 4 or trade down in the first round. The Cardinals finished 4-13 last season. There are holes all over the roster. The Cardinals, who have the 27th pick in the first round, could acquire even more first round picks via trade to build up their roster, or stick and pick a player such as Ohio State wide receiver Marvin Harrison Jr. to aid a thinning receiving core. The Chargers, on the other hand, are in a similar predicament at number 5. Los Angeles is in the midst of turning over its roster to fit new head coach Jim Harbaugh's scene. The Chargers have plenty of positions of need coming off a 5-12 season. The Chargers currently own 9 total picks in this year's draft, the most for any franchise since 2021. The team's wide receiver room was depleted this offseason after the Chargers released Mike Williams and traded away Keenan Allen. The Chargers are faced with the option of staying put at number 5 and possibly selecting one of the top receiver prospects in this year's draft, such as Harrison, LSU's Malik Nabers, or Washington's Rome Adunze. Or they could trade the pick to a QB needy team in an effort to accumulate more picks for themselves. New Chargers general manager Joe Hortitz said Thursday his draft philosophy is to draft the best player available, and it will take an extremely attractive offer for the team to move out of number 5. They have to make it an attractive, very attractive offer for us to move away, he says. The whole thing, I think, is a fair trade, then it would be a wash, but I don't think there's a trade that we're interested in. in terms of where we're sitting, we believe we actually have the first pick of run of quarterbacks, he says, echoing Harborough to the annual league meeting last month. People have called about interest in coming up to us, and we've had conversations. I think we'll have more conversations throughout this week. Some I've already had. We'll have them throughout the weekend through next week, and then again on draft day, he adds. The Cardinals and Chargers might not reach a verdict until they are each on the clock, but whatever the two teams decide will have a ripple effect on the opening round. Paula.
Continuing in sports, Chinese scandal raises 24 concerns. With 2 months to go until the U.S. Olympic swimming trials and 3 months to go until the 2024 Olympic Games, the question hanging over the international swimming community isn't how many medals America's Katie Ledecky or France's Léon Marchand will win in Paris. It's this. How did a banned prescription heart medicine that is available only in pill form somehow get spread around a hotel kitchen in such a way to be ingested in some manner by 23 elite Chinese swimmers, all of whom had been warned for years not to ingest anything they don't trust? Do we believe that really happened? And if we don't believe that really happened, then we are watching in real time as the worst doping scandal in swimming in at least a generation envelops a sport that will dominate the first week of the Summer Games. This weekend, the New York Times and German public broadcaster ARD reported that those three Chinese swimmers all tested positive for the exact same banned substance, trimetazidine, TMZ, which is the drug Russian figure skater Kamila Valieva was found to have taken, but were allowed to continue to compete and in some cases win medals at the Tokyo Olympic Games in 2021. How is that possible? Because the World Anti-Doping Agency clearly bought the Chinese story, focusing on the small amounts of the drug that the swimmers apparently ingested, even as it fought for months to bring Valieva to justice when she went with a strikingly similar excuse. In a story that's still ongoing more than 2 years after 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics, the Russian teenager said she was exposed to her grandfather's TMZ when the drug made its way into a strawberry dessert that he made and she ate. WADA didn't buy it. Honestly, who would? And neither did the Court of Arbitration for Sport, which banned Valieva for 4 years, disqualifying her Olympic results. We'll be comparing and contrasting these two cases for some time, and Valieva and the Russians might too. They have appealed her punishment, and one wonders if WADA's decision in the Chinese case might play to her advantage now. One key question has emerged. Did WADA share with the Valieva defense team the information that in a similar situation, the 23 Chinese swimmers, WADA kept the positive drug test secret from the public and did not suspend or disqualify the swimmers? So far, no one in the position of authority has been willing to answer that. Another issue is percolating is the decision to neither suspend nor disqualify the Chinese swimmers' final, or is there an opportunity for the case to be reopened? The statute of limitations has not run out, U.S. Anti-Doping Agency CEO Travis Tygart said in the next message Sunday. Certainly, if any new evidence is found after an actual robust investigation or fraud in the defense of the Chinese swimmers is found, then yes, it could be easily prosecuted. So it can and should be investigated and prosecuted by an independent prosecutor to get some justice for clean athletes, whatever that might end up being. Also on Sunday, German Interior Minister Nancy Faeser called for an independent investigation into the case. One of the reasons this story resonates as it does throughout the swimming and Olympic world is that doping and international swimming sadly go back a long way. Most notably, East Germany ruined the lives of many of its female swimmers from the 1960s through the 1980s by forcing them to take steroids for years while stealing Olympic and world medals from hundreds of clean swimmers around the world. Now, another scandal. Said Tygart, our hearts ache for the athletes from the countries who were impacted by this potential cover-up and who may have lost podium moments, financial opportunities, and memories with family that can never be replaced. They've been deeply and painfully betrayed by the system. All of those with these dirty hands in burying positive tests and suppressing the voices of courageous whistleblowers must be held accountable to the fullest extent of the rules and law. China and WADA thought this case was over and done with. The swimming world knows, however, that this might only be the beginning.
And Garcia makes good on pre-fight victory remark. Mike Tyson stopped by Ryan Garcia's locker room Saturday night in Brooklyn and praised the shirtless King Rye before Garcia fought Devin Haney. "Have you been eating bricks?" Tyson asked. Garcia replied, "Yes, I'm going to eat Haney today as well." "You look beautiful," Tyson says. Smiling, Garcia thanked the former heavyweight champion. And during a celebratory moment after Garcia knocked Haney down three times and won the fight by majority decision, Garcia asked, "Hey, where's Mike at? Mike Tyson come through." Tyson was a busy man during his trip to New York for the fight, based on videos posted on his Instagram account. At one point, Tyson ended up shirtless on the streets and playfully tussled with Shannon Briggs, the former heavyweight champion. He also visited Times Square and admired a giant electric billboard for Tyson 2.0, his personal brand of marijuana, "Grow Like Mike," it read. According to Tyson's publicist, Iron Mike will stop using marijuana while training for his fight against Jake Paul on July 20th, but he didn't agree to stop selling it. Jake Paul reacts to the Garcia-Haney fight. Jake Paul relayed his thoughts on X, formerly known as Twitter, while watching the fight with his brother Logan and girlfriend. "This is the craziest fight I've ever seen," he posted. Garcia scored three knockdowns, and each time Haney rose to his feet. "Man, what an amazing fight, and so unexpected," Jake Paul wrote. "I seriously can't breathe. And both are warriors and savages, and never underestimate anyone. That's what I keep saying." A video showed Jake Paul standing as he waited for the judges' scorecards to be announced. He covered his mouth in apparent surprise after hearing the results. And Garcia offers post-fight thoughts. After going dark on social media for most of the day, Saturday leading up to his fight, Garcia went back at it on X not long after his victory. Among his comments, "Ref, that seventh round should have been stopped," he wrote, referring to his first knockdown of Haney. He also didn't think his point deduction for hitting on the break in the seventh round was warranted. "Never received a warning," Garcia wrote. Haney also took to X and wrote of himself, "Fought like a true champion, got up off the canvas and kept fighting. I'm 100% okay, but would love to do it again while we both make weight." Likewise, Garcia said he would welcome a rematch with Haney. Paula?
Quick rundown of the NHL postseason power rankings. Carolina-Dallas enter playoffs strong. In March, the Colorado Avalanche seemed to be a solid pick to win their second Stanley Cup title in three seasons. Then April happened. The Avalanche played four games against playoff teams, lost three in blowouts, and blew a 3-0 lead in another. They did beat the Edmonton Oilers in the regular season finale, but that team was resting seven top players. A 7-0 loss to the Winnipeg Jets, a team they play in the first round, cost them home ice advantage and gave Winnipeg a 3-0 record against Colorado with a 17-4 edge in goals. With the Stanley Cup playoffs having started Saturday, here are the USA Sports NHL power rankings based on a team's ability to win it all. I'll read the description about the Carolina Hurricanes, and then I'll give the top lineups. The Hurricanes reached the conference final last season despite missing injured Andrei Shvetnikov for the entire playoffs. In addition to having a healthy Shvetnikov, Carolina added former Stanley Cup winners Jake Gunstel and Evgeny Kuznetsov at the trade deadline. Gunstel has 58 points in 58 playoff games and scored 25 points in 17 games since the trade. Kuznetsov was a key player with the Washington Capitals, won the 2018 Stanley Cup. The Hurricanes have a deep defense and goalie, Frederick Anderson, who's been nearly unbeatable since he returned from treatment for blood clots. The concern for the Hurricanes? The Hurricanes played Anderson every other game down the stretch. Is he ready to take on a heavier load? And number two, Dallas Stars. The Stars also got to the conference final last season, and they're deeper than last season when they lost to the Golden Knights. They get scoring up and down the lineup, and they've improved their impressive defense corps by adding Chris Tanev at the deadline. Goalie Jake Ottinger was inconsistent this season, but he was strong in April and seems to turn it up a notch in the playoffs. The concern? They're facing the defending champions in the first round, and Vegas went 3-0 in the season series. Here are the contenders they list in rank order: New York Rangers, Florida Panthers, Edmonton Oilers, Winnipeg Jets, the Boston Bruins, Tampa Bay Lightning, Vegas Golden Knights, Vancouver Canucks, Colorado Avalanche, Toronto Maple Leafs, Nashville Predators, New York Islanders, Los Angeles Kings, and number 16 at the bottom, Washington Capitals.
And thank you, Paula, kicking off our life section. Being that it is Earth Day today, there's a special section here of Just Curious. You've got questions, we've got answers. And this is going to be about recycling. Recycling is collecting and reusing material that would otherwise be thrown away. In the U.S., this happens in a three-part process. Collection is recyclable materials are gathered by individuals or businesses and sent away. Processing is recyclables are sorted, cleaned, and prepared for a facility, while remanufacturing is recyclables made into new products or a plant facility. And does it work? Well, recycling has been an important environmental achievement and community benefits. Outside of reducing landfill waste, recycling prevents pollution and further greenhouse gas emissions because discarded goods can be made into new ones. Recycled steel saves 60% of production energy, and recycled plastic saves 70% of production energy, according to the National Institute of Health's Environmental Management System. And further information on this Earth Day, the U.S. doesn't have a federal recycling program. It leaves it to towns to decide on local measures, including the types of plastic they are able to collect and recycle. And because many of the items that end up in the recycling stream aren't actually recyclable, those often end up going to the landfill. Only 9% of all plastic waste ever gets recycled, however. How and when to recycle locally? To search how and where to recycle in your community, use Earth 911's recycling database. This is search.earth911.com or Keep America Beautiful's I Want to Be Recycled at kab.org/recycling, and you can filter by your zip code and the type of material that you're looking for. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, almost 94 tons of municipal solid waste are recycled and composed in 2018, about 32%. But there's also a looming issue of contamination, rendering the material collected for recycling unable to be recycled. About 17% of community collected recycling is contaminated, a 2020 Recycling Partnership report found. Earth Day is a good time to learn about recycling, and here are some tips to keep handy the next time you're throwing out a container, piece of paper, or odd household item. This is a general guide of what the EPA says can and can't be recycled. Your state or city may have different guidelines, so make sure to check those beforehand. Paper products, in general, paper needs to be dry and free of food scraps. You do not need to remove staples, labels, or stickers. Usually recyclable is newspapers, magazines, pizza boxes, even if they have grease on them, mail, even with plastic windows, cardboard boxes and containers, the cardboard roll from toilet paper, paper with ink on it, cardboard tubes from toilet paper or paper towels as well. Usually not recyclable, hygiene or sanity products such as tissues, napkins, wipes, or paper towels. Toilet paper, wax paper, receipts, shredded paper, sticky notes, and plastic-coated paper. Plastics themselves and those containers usually have a triangle with a number somewhere on the packaging that show how they were made. Compare this symbol to your local recycling guidelines to find out if it's eligible for recycling. Note, these two types of plastics typically can not be recycled in household bins. Plastic wraps, bags and films, and styrofoam. You cannot recycle compostable plastics. Glass, food, and beverage containers can be reused several times and are cheaper in a way to make glass. Glass of different colors and types can be mixed together as long as you separate the glass from other materials such as plastic or such as metal or plastic caps. You should not include broken glass in your recycling practices. Aluminum cans and foil can both be recycled as long as they do not contain food residue. According to the EPA, you do not need to crush aluminum cans before recycling because they can even be more difficult to sort at the single-stream facilities that many towns use. Other issues and other items, batteries should not go in household garbage or recycling bins, but they can be dropped off at local collection points for recycling. Electronics can be dropped off at specific collection sites to be recycled or donated. Metal, check your state or city for local metal recycling programs. Used oil should not be disposed of in the drain because of its toxicity, but can be recycled at a local facility for reuse. Paula.
Heading over to music news and reviews from the Life section, Mariah Carey. Carey urges fans to protect your dreams. From Las Vegas, moments before wrapping her glossy and efficient new residency show, Mariah Carey wanted to share a message. Protect your dreams, she intoned on video as the text scrolled across a halo of lighting. It's all about faith. For me, I can't define it, but it has defined me. Uplifting messages permeate Carey's production at Dolby Live at Park MGM, officially dubbed Mariah Carey, the celebration of Mimi Live in Las Vegas. The 90-minute show, Carey's third Vegas residency, premiered last week in honor of the near 20-year anniversary of the album The Emancipation of Mimi. After performances on April 24, 26, and 27, she'll return for 8 dates in July and August. Tickets go on sale at 10 a.m. Pacific Time Friday via Ticketmaster. What songs does Carey play in her new Vegas residency? Much like U2's run at the Sphere, where Achtung Baby grabbed the spotlight, Carey's show ostensibly highlights her hip-hop-inflected return to 2005. Mimi not only snagged 8 Grammy nominations in 2006, but with bright production from Jermaine Dupri, it birthed hits Shake It Off, We Belong Together, and It's Like That, among others. Devout fans will cherish hearing Fly Like a Bird, which closes her set, and I Wish You Knew, as neither song has been played frequently since 2006. Likewise, Circles, which has rarely been heard on stage in a decade, and the equally infrequent Say Something. But from the moment a stately curtain parted to connect Carey, 55, with her lambs, her thigh-bearing champagne-colored gown perfectly positioned and her honey-hued hair cascading onto her shoulders, it was apparent Carey's decades of hits wouldn't be shunned. As sliding platforms glided behind her, Carey dug into Vision of Love, hitting her glass-shattering notes with seeming ease. A pack of male dancers slipped on and off the stage as Carey tiptoed in stilettos to get closer to fans bearing gifts, shimmied through Make It Happen. During a lush ballad combo, Can't Let Go, and her searing cover of the Jackson 5's I'll Be There, Carey looked beatific as her chin quivered while again reaching for those skyscraper notes. Most of the songs were reproduced in full, but it's too bad. Her rewarding take on Without You, the aching ballad most associated with Harry Nilsson, was one of the few presented in shortened form. But from the peak syrup of Hero to the thumping beat of Fantasy, Carey offered fans a gratifying overview of her own eras. Carey carries herself like a diva, but is she really? One of the most endearing traits about Carey is that while she enlists two of her dancers to carry the train of one of her beaded gowns as she arrives to sing Circles and grins while her makeup is retouched at the start of Say Something, it all unfolds with obvious self-deprecation. Carey might be gussied up in high-end couture from designers including Gaurav Gupta and Robert One, but she's a Long Islander at heart, a down-to-earth entertainer with undiminished moxie and quick wit. My earring fell off. We're getting off to a wonderful start, she joked after a couple of songs at Wednesday's performance. She shared a story about Aretha Franklin tutoring her not to accept anyone playing games while rehearsing for the 1998 Divas Live concert, and frequently tried to sign swag, or in this night, a forearm for the zealous fans clustered at the front of the stage. I want to sign all these things, but it's too hard, Carrie said with mock exasperation. In reality, she was a bit too far to safely lean into the crowd. The luminous Carrie positions herself as an untouchable diva, and indeed, the show segment that featured her reclining on a blush velvet couch for the dramatic ballad Looking In furthered the expectation. But the maven of the Lambly, that has supported her for decades, isn't so much a prima donna, but an icon.
And remote workers with dreams of working from the rolling hills of Tuscany or the cliffs of Italy are now one step closer to making that reality. This is because Italy has launched a new digital nomad visa. 2 years after its announcement, the highly anticipated digital nomad visa officially became available for those eligible on April 4th. Italian style, everything happens slowly, said Nick Metta, a lawyer for the law firm Studio Legale Metta, which has helped Americans relocate to Italy for decades. Now there's a pipeline of people waiting just to file the application. That's a long-awaited visa, he says. Most of Meta's clients would previously have applied for a student visa, which allowed them to work part-time in Italy. However, under this new visa, people will be able to work from Italy for 1 year with the option to renew once. With an option to renew once it's due for expiration. So you get 1 year and then you get to do it again for one other year if you'd like. Without a visa, U.S. travelers could only stay in Italy for up to 90 days without the ability to work. Launch makes Italy the latest European country to offer a digital nomad visa, which has already been available in Greece and Hungary. Here's everything you need to know about this digital nomad visa for Italy. According to the official decree, the visa is meant for those who carry out a highly qualified work activity through the use of technological tools that allow you to work remotely. To qualify for this visa, the applicant has to meet certain requirements: a university or college degree or accredited professional license, 6 months of work experience in the industry, or 5 years for applicants without a university degree, an existing employment contract, a criminal record check, and proof of annual income minimum of 28,000 euros, which is about 29,800 American dollars, evidence of housing in Italy, evidence of health insurance coverage. And applicants can also apply to have family members join them on their Italian move, but the government has to give the final approval. Thankfully, Meta says that paperwork for the digital nomad visa isn't too complicated. The first step, if you're interested, would be the Italian consulate for the area that you're interested in going to. Consulates are basically the front of the government to receive the applications, he says. How much would the visa cost? According to Studio Legale Meta, the application fee is 116 euros. That is approximately $124 per person. How long will it take? Not too long, Meta says, but he says keep in mind it's the slow process of the Italian way of life. He estimates that process could take about 3 weeks if applicants are well organized and they have all their documents filed. And you have been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Joe Pinella
and Paula Passmore
have been reading from the USA Today. This broadcast is generously supported by the Forest at Duke. They can be reached at 800-474-0258. We thank them for their contribution. And the content of this program is intended for those who are blind and print impaired. And it's readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by visiting our website at www.ncreadingservice.org. Please tune in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for our exercise program and at 9:30 a.m. for readings from the News and Observer. Up next is our featured program, Drug and Department Store Ads. Thank you for listening.